Cool.
Any questions or comments from last time?
Any lights? So, how are you guys praying since it's a smaller group? Is this helping you to pray better? Are you consistently praying?
After both praying once,
better. Okay. All right, good. Especially the mental prayer, right? Like, that's, if you're going to have like your Lenten things you want to do, that should be one of them. All right, so we're going to talk about penance and mortification, which is not really the most pleasant topic, but hopefully we'll talk about it and it will make sense, and then you'll see why it is actually a good thing. All right, so what does it mean to repent? And I know way too much to give you guys the answer on the slides that I didn't bother looking at.
To acknowledge that you did something wrong and ask for forgiveness.
All right, so there's an acknowledgement of doing something wrong. Okay. Is that sufficient? Asking for forgiveness, certainly part of that, right? My bad.
I feel like
is that enough?
I think part of it is like, almost vowing to not do that again.
Okay, so a firm purpose of amendment would be part of it. What else?
Try to fix what you are.
Oh, there it is. That is the key. So not only does it mean to say you're sorry, to stop what you're doing, but it means to start going in the right direction, right? And we start going in the right direction by fixing it, right? So if you think about, if you were summing up a column of numbers and you made a mistake in the middle of it, you wouldn't just pick up from there, right? You would actually go back, find your mistake, and pick up from there. So that's the idea, okay? So let's look a little bit about then what I want us to sort of walk away with today is a positive view of penance, okay? Not something to be scared of, not something to avoid, but to see why God does what he does, okay? He's a loving father. Not just a slave driver and not just a bookkeeper, but wanting to turn us into something, sons and daughters, right? So let's look at what the original sin is, and let's look at what sin is in and of itself, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. So this is Eve. The woman saw that the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eyes, and the tree was desirable for gaining wisdom. So she took some of its fruit and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. All right, so there's two pieces of sin here. What are the two parts? Well, what did she do? She disobeyed. That's the first part, right? So the sort of breaking of the moral law. But there was something else that, why did she do it?
Maybe pride trying to keep wisdom.
Well, there's pride, but what else? Think more. Pride is part of it for sure.
The serpent promised that she would be like God.
Well, yeah. So she was trying to gain something. How about the pleasure she got from eating it? Right, it was good for food and pleasing to the eyes, and the tree was desirable for gaining wisdom. Right, so there's two parts of sin, right? The disobedience, and then the sort of the pleasure or the forbidden fruit. Right? So, good thing. Why do we sin? There's only two reasons why we sin, right? Yeah, because it feels good. And that feels good in the sense of just like a bodily thing, right? Like everything we've talked about. Because pride is like the primo sin. And, you know, it's because it makes us feel better about ourselves, but also out of fear, right? So, the two things that we, two reasons why we sin are pleasure and fear. And so, pleasure is a good thing, but it's a means to an end, right? God attaches pleasures to things in order for to kind of move us towards them, right? So, for instance, eating. Why is eating pleasurable? Well, because it's something we have to do, right? But if we eat solely for the pleasure, now we've sort of gone, made the pleasure an end in itself instead of a means to eating, right? And so every time we sin, we disobey and we steal pleasure. Okay, think of it that way. And again, don't think in the terms of just like bodily feelings, but think of also even in the spirit how we have pleasure from it. Okay. All right. So if we're going to fix it, what do you think we have to do?
Repent.
fix those two things, right? Okay, and that's at the heart of penance, or what it means to repent. So let's look at the first part, the part of the disobedience. All right, so there is what is called the debt of guilt and punishment. Now, if you guys know the story of David, so David gets caught in an act of adultery, and Nathan, the prophet, comes to him. Nathan tells him a story, and then he says, well, you are that man. And David says, that man should die. And so what does God do? Well, God removes his sin. For his part, the Lord has removed your sin. Since you have utterly spurned the Lord by this deed, the child born to you will surely die. So it seems a little bit counterintuitive, right? So if God forgave him, why does he still have to, why does the child still have to die? Yeah, there's a temporal punishment that goes with our actions, okay, or a consequence of sin, right? And so God forgives the guilt, but doesn't remove the punishment, right? We'll see in a minute when we talk about Jesus, but so he removes the eternal punishment, but not the temporal punishment. So let's talk about the distinction between those two things. And whoa, that slide was huge, sorry. All right, so this is out of the catechism, and since I cut off the bottom, I'll try to read it the best I can. To understand this doctrine and practice of the church, it is necessary to understand that sin has a double consequence. This is what we're talking about. Grave sin deprives us of communion with God and therefore makes us incapable of eternal life, the privation of which is called the eternal punishment of sin. On the other hand, every sin, even venial, entails an unhealthy attachment to creatures, which must be purified either here on earth or after death in a state called purgatory. This purification frees one from what is called the temporal punishment for sin. These two punishments must not be conceived of as a kind of vengeance inflicted by God from without, but as following from the very nature of sin. A conversion which proceeds from a fervent charity can attain the complete purification of the sinner in such a way. I'll stop right there since I have no idea what the last line is. But the point is that with sin, there is both an eternal consequence and a temporal consequence. So an eternal consequence and a consequence in time. Okay, and a lot of the consequence in time has to do with what it does to us. Right. So if you lie, well, you lied, right? Lie again. Now you're starting down a little bit of a habit, right? Lie 3, 4, 5 times, you become what? A liar, right? So sin turns us into something. And that's the idea. So how do we stop that habit or that tendency, right? Well, grace, but also penance or mortification, okay? All right, so let's get a definition here, and then we'll start to talk about it a little bit. Now, penance consists in contrition of the soul and mortification of the body. These parts are essential to it. The soul has willed the sin. The body has frequently cooperated in its commission. Okay, so what is he talking about? So there's the idea that when I sin, it's really me trying to have my own way, right? Ultimately. I'm insisting that I know more than God, that I know it's better for me than God does, and it's just me insisting that I have my own way, okay? So what happens when we suffer? Well, yeah, so what if we suffer? Let's just take something. Let's just say we suffer unjustly. See, the part of it, certainly, that we recognize that it's not our will. So what should be our response to that? If we're looking at it from a spirit of penance. Well, not necessarily happy, right? But but you should accept it willingly because it repairs what you took away, okay? And not just repairs like this cosmic order thing, although it does, but it also repairs inside of you, right? And so what you have to do then is you have to actively will the suffering. Thy will be done, right? This is Christ in the garden. right? So it restores justice, but it also restores order within us, right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? Yes. So I want us to understand the logic of sort of punishment first before we jump into penance.
Unjustly?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily even to be unjust, it's just something we haven't chosen to suffer.
Okay.
Maybe unjustly, was, it, that pushes us into another question, but something we haven't chosen to suffer. I mean, it seems pretty obvious when, you know, if I steal someone's car and I end up in jail for that, that's just punishment, right? But it doesn't always seem obvious if I steal someone's car and get away with it, that later on, you know, my car breaks down. Like, you know, it seems like, well, how are those two things related? And they're not necessarily related, but our response to the second one could be to repair from the first, okay? Does that make sense? All right, so why does God do that? Why is forgiveness not enough?
Justice.
Okay, so justice is certainly a huge part of it. What, didn't Jesus already take care of that?
I feel like we're weak. We don't learn by being told what to do. We learn by 2x4 across the face.
Yeah. That, I mean, that is exactly part of it, right? So there is the learning part of it that, you know, it usually takes a little bit of turning up the volume, right, to go, hey, stupid. But why else? Why would God do that? Why does he set it up like that? Come back to it in just a second. So St. Peter says something weird in Acts that we actually say in the Creed, and if you don't think about it enough, you might miss what he's really saying. So when he meets this Gentile Cornelius and he preaches Jesus to him, he calls him, he commissioned us to preach to the people and testify that he is the one appointed by God as judge of the living and the dead. And it's the same thing you hear in the Creed, right? What does that mean? Christ is the judge of the living.
Does this have to do with, like, which punishments, temporal punishments we get while we're here?
It has everything to do with that. Right? So, God isn't just, and this is important for us to understand, because a lot of people look at God as this sort of harsh judge, right? At the end of time, you're going to go before him, and he's going to have this sort of two columns and you hope that you're in the black, right? But if we begin to look at him as the judge of the living, that changes the way we look at him. So in other words, he's judging our actions even now. Okay. Why? Why is he judging our actions even now? Why would he do that? This will be sort of like, go ahead, Sarah. Here.
I was going to say, kind of what Stephen was talking about, learning earlier, like, we just waited to judge us until we had, like, until the end of our lives, and we weren't necessarily learned in time enough to, like, repent and do better.
Exactly. So punishment has, if we sort of summarize, the punishment has two purposes, right? The first purpose obviously has to do with justice, right? We take pleasure in something we shouldn't have taken pleasure in, and God then removes the pleasure from something that normally would be pleasurable, right? But the second has to do with us repairing ourselves, right? So all punishment is sort of rehabilitative, okay? It ought to be both, right? It ought to be a punishment and a rehabilitation, right? And if we forget that God's judgments in time are meant to rehabilitate us, that's when we begin to see him as this sort of mean, you know, eternal killjoy with his ledger, keeping us in line at the end of time when we look at fear. So the point is that at every moment our actions are being judged so that we begin to act like sons and daughters of God, right? There's a certain dignity to being sons and daughters of God. And so our punishments are meant to, in time at least, are meant to rehabilitate us, all right? Yes?
What about punishments for the souls that are damned to hell?
Yeah, so they would be beyond, rehabilitation. Then it's strictly justice, right? And we can talk more about that in a few minutes when we start. We're going to talk a little bit about purgatory and we'll talk about hell, too.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, not all punishment. I mean, sometimes people are beyond rehabilitation, right? So think of it in those terms. And not every time when you punish someone do they actually change their behavior. And in that case, they're not able to change their behavior. All right, so let's talk then a little bit just about the logic of penance, okay? So I said sort of at the beginning of the semester that there were four or five saints that we would talk a lot about, and today we're going to talk a lot about Saint Thérèse. All right, so here's what Saint Thérèse says. All right, do you guys remember the story of Saint Thérèse a little bit? All right, so Saint Thérèse is a early 20th century, late 19th century French saint who grew up in a very Catholic family. Both of her parents have been canonized, one of her sisters and another sister's. Her cause for canonization is open. So a very holy family. And she wanted to join a convent. And she was 15 years old, and she went on a pilgrimage to Rome, and they had an audience with the Pope, and she goes running up to the Pope asking if she can join a convent at 15 years old, and at the time wasn't allowed. And so the Pope sort of just like laughs at her a little bit and says, well, if your bishop says it's okay, it's okay. And turns out that, you know, she goes back home and she's allowed to enter the convent, and she remains hidden there for the next 10 years, and she dies at 24. And no one ever heard of her, really nothing remarkable about her, except for one thing. Before she died, they asked her to write a diary, okay, about her life and her conversion. And in that diary, what's contained is what's called the Little Way. And it's essentially her spirituality about how to become a saint and how she became a saint. She said very, very specifically that she was going to be, not that she wanted to be, she was going to be a great saint. She said she was going to be a great saint because she knew that God could do that. Okay, so it's absolute, just total abandonment to God, knowing that she could never do it on her own, but he put the desire in her. So she said, well, if you put the desire there, you must want it, so then make me a saint. Okay, and she says, I don't have to be a great, you know, I don't have to be the most beautiful, just make me a little flower in your garden. Okay, and so she lives like that. She lives with this radical sort of dependence on God. And finds, well, you know, I don't find it in me to do these great penances that all the saints did. I don't find it in me to be, you know, out in the world doing all these things. And so she makes this offering to God, and she says she just wants to be a victim of his love. So she's like, there's so many people in the world that reject your love, just pour it all out on me. All right? So it sounds good, right? Like, make yourself a victim of God's love. That means everything's going to be great, right? Right? Because it's a fatherly love, right? And she had, admittedly, even though she is a great saint, a doctor of the church, she had a lot of faults that needed to be purified. But she knew deep down that God would choose the most gentle way, because that's what he does, the Father, to correct her. Right? And so she suffered greatly. She had tuberculosis, died at 24. That sort of tells you how much she suffered. But she had this radical understanding that even in her sufferings, they were touches of God's love, okay? And because they were the gentlest way for her to suffer. All right? So he could have chosen many, many ways to clear out her imperfections, but he, being a loving father, chose the most gentle ways. All right? And that's not just her, it's all of us, okay? That's the idea. All right? So if you really want to be perfected, then you have to radically trust God that what he sends to you is what is absolutely best for you at any given time. Okay? And it's meant to make you into a saint. All of us are meant to be saints. All right, so that's her idea. So she gives herself to, you know, she calls him the divine physician. She gives herself to the doctor and then says, well, I know you're going to have to do surgery on me, but you'll be gentle. Okay? And I mean, it's a good analogy because, you know, once a doctor starts operating, what's the last thing you want to do? stop it, right? Because that's when it's really painful. So she just said, you know, I know you can't heal me without first wounding me, so then do it, okay? And again, she admits, I'm not, you know, I don't have it in me to do these great things. Like, she talks about some of the penances. Like, she had this, which I always wondered, like, she kept it hidden from this one nun that she lived with, that I guess every time they would be in a room praying, she had this habit of clicking. Like, she'd breathe for a few minutes and then go, like that. And it drove her nuts. And she wanted to just reach over and just whack her, right? And so she says, like, and she, of course, writes this in the diary, right? So the nun actually finds out later on that she was annoying her. But she says that she, this was one of her mortifications, she would always make sure she smiled at her, and she was the first one that she would go to talk to when they had time to talk. So she went out of her way, because this woman annoyed her, to be charitable to her. And then she even said, you know, on her death, or they said on her deathbed, this nun was like serving her and thought they were best friends. Which again, probably not after she read the diary, but still. But anyway, so this diary is written, and it was meant to be just for the Carmelites. But somehow it got out, and so millions of copies, and then suddenly everyone knew who this little girl Therese Martin was. But anyway, the idea that's really important is understanding that God, as a loving Father, always chooses the most gentle way to correct us. Yes?
So, is this a situation where God is allowing hardship, or is God giving the hardship?
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, because it sort of goes around your question about hell. So, we may have, I don't remember when we talked about this, it may have been a few semesters ago, about God's active will and his permissive will, right, where God can permit evil so that some good will come about, but he can never actively will evil, right? And that's fine and good for, you know, for like a theological explanation, but all the saints would say, okay, everything that happens because God is provident, just look at it as coming from his hand. If he permits it, then he's permitting it for your own good. If he, you know, if he is actively doing it, then it's good anyway. So usually, no, not usually, always, never make that distinction, like, in your own life. Like, you can, when you're talking to someone or you try to understand it, that's fine. But always see everything that happens, because God is provident, as coming directly from him as a sign of love. All right? And that's why the idea of her, you know, saying she's going to be a victim of his love. Okay? So that, I mean, it's a great question, because some people get hung up on it. Well, if it's evil, why does God do it? It's just in our own lives, don't try not to get caught up in that. Just look at it as coming from God's hand. All right, does that make sense?
What does it mean to say that God is provident?
So when we talk about God is provident, so everything that happens is part of God's plan. Okay? However, he will use secondary causes to bring it about. But if he wants to give you the good of holiness, then he will allow certain things to happen in order to bring that about. And he only does it because, one, it's the most gentle way, but there is no better way to bring it about. And so if we intellectualize that and accept that, then we realize, okay, whatever happens came from his loving hand. And it's just, you know, even as a parent, I can understand that, because there's times when I have to be harsher on my kids. And even, you know, watch them cry when they're like, why are you being so mean to me? And I'm like, no, it's okay. You know, this is for your own good. What was your question, sir?
When you were talking about allowing for, like, evil things, like, I can clearly see that, for example, like, if someone were, like, to murder a family member, like, that's evil. But are you also talking about, like, natural things, like her tuberculosis as a potentially evil thing?
Or? Yeah, everything. So, like, even, like, a hurricane, for, like, look at, like, Puerto Rico, right? Like, the reason why God allowed that to happen in Puerto Rico was because there was some good in the world that could only come about through that hurricane. Now, not just a single good, but lots of them, right? And us being fallen, very often, it's not until suffering happens. You see this, right? You see where people, no one really cares what happens to those poor people in Puerto Rico until, like, something actually really bad happened to them, even though their life is not all that great to begin with, right? And so now all these people are suddenly concerned with them that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Right, and so would you say that, like, the hurricane is actually evil, or it's just...
You'd call it a natural evil. Okay. It's not in the original sort of, you know, creation where we should be harmed by things in nature, right? So when man falls, it creates a discord not only between God and man and between man and man, but between man and nature too. Okay. Yes.
So sometimes evil happens because of men. And so, if God wants some evil to happen and somebody does it, like, is he free of the evil? I don't know.
You mean the person who actually commits it?
Yeah.
No, that nun, again, I don't know what her motives was. She was still annoying. And, I mean, regardless of whether, but what St. Therese came to understand was, actually, God is teaching me patience through this. And therefore, I'm grateful for it.
I'm talking about someone like a dictator who has killed a lot of people, which we can still think it's good. But if God willed it,
so that's where the intellectual part of it that you have to kind of work through to understand. In that case, like the Holocaust, right? God allows that to happen; He doesn't directly will it. But once it actually happens, then our response ought to be, hey, okay, what are you trying to teach me through this, God? Does that make sense?
But what about the person who, if God wanted it, like, there should be some secondary cause, and in this case...
Yeah. So God wanted the good that came about from it, but He didn't want those means to do it. Does that make sense? So he permitted those means to the end, but he only because he wanted the end. Only because he wanted the thing that was going to happen. So he permitted the means to it. Alright. Does that make sense? Okay, so... Alright, so that is the... Again, I want to make sure that, you know, just sort of like last week when we talked about bumping over an intellectual issue, I want us to make sure we really grasp this one truth that everything that comes to us comes from the hands of a loving Father. Okay? And that we don't need to necessarily run away from it. Okay? Yes?
What does that do with, like, current and our suffering? Is that bad?
Okay, so not necessarily, no. I mean, think of it in terms of, now it becomes a question of how to pray while you're suffering. So do we pray for our suffering to end? Yeah, because suffering is still a bad thing, right? Even though we find good in it. But as we begin to develop that mindset, maybe we're now praying, oh, don't let me miss, you know, the graces that you've attached to this, right? And, you know, I think in my own life, like the times I've most acutely suffered, I mean, I can even remember my prayer being, are you sure this seems like enough? But as you get into it, again, if you have that attitude of, well, the doctor's already opened me, to get off the operating table now would be really stupid. That changes it a little bit, because you're like, well, you already started, like, you know, and not to mention, like, I can't necessarily change it. So you then begin to ask, you begin to just ask for the grace to suffer well, rather than necessarily end it. Because you know when, again, having that attitude of God being a loving Father and only giving you what you need, that when it's served its course, it will end. Okay? But there's nothing wrong with praying not to be in pain, right? Not to suffer. That's normal. That's a good thing. But sort of the higher thing is to just make sure you don't miss the graces attached to it. Alright. Okay, so that's the intellectual sort of part of it to grasp is, okay, everything that happens because, you know, don't get in sort of the worldly view. Well, everything happens for a reason, but everything happens because God has something He wants to give you, and that's the only package He can give it to you in, okay? All right, so let's talk a little bit about purgatory, okay? This ties right into it. How many of you would like to live your purgatory now? But be, I mean, stand up and say, yes, I want my purgatory now. Like, Ryan at least answered with, like, a little bit of, I know this sounds so counterintuitive. You want your purgatory now. Okay? Because it's not pleasant later on. Okay? Because, well, purgatory is hard, right? And it's, you don't have the graces that you have now. Jesus isn't helping you along. You're sort of suffering on your own, getting the prayers of other people. But you should regularly pray to live your purgatory now. Okay? And in fact, so I know it's counterintuitive, like, and I don't like making that prayer because it's scary. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about in a minute why it's scary. And then maybe we can talk about sort of the issue with it. But so Saint Therese, again, in a letter to one of the nuns at her convent, basically said, a lot of people will say things like, "I'm just trying to get to purgatory," right? Like, I've heard it plenty of times, right? I mean, will we realistically get the purgatory? Maybe, but you don't want to shoot for purgatory because you miss. You're not going to end up in purgatory. Yeah. But so Saint Therese was sort of dealing with this. She's like, you know, you fear purgatory. Why don't you just not go to purgatory? Why don't you live your life as if, you know, you're going to do it all here and now? Okay. And I think that's sort of a good way to look at it. You do not have enough trust, right? It starts with the trust that God is giving me. Because guess what? The time you spend in purgatory separated from God, He doesn't want that, right? He made us. I mean, the time you're separated from Him is, I won't say it's God suffering, because He doesn't suffer, but there's a certain aspect of it in sort of an analogous way, that if we would just trust God and know that He's going to purify us, then we wouldn't worry about it, okay? All right, so let me talk a little bit about the fear of suffering, which I don't have a slide for this, but as I'm talking, I think this is a good thing for us to talk about. So I think very often when I say that, you know, that you're going to be, you have to do penance, you're going to suffer, we all cringe, right? Naturally. Okay. Now, if I told you very specifically what you were going to suffer and why, do you cringe? No, right? You just go, okay, I'll do that or I won't do that. Okay. So what was the difference between the two? Yeah, we get scared of the abstract, right? Of course I'm scared of suffering, because what does my mind do? It goes to the worst possible thing, right? What is the worst possible thing that can happen to me? Oh, that's it. I'm scared of it. I don't want to suffer. But that's not, again, that's not really how God operates, right? That's not, again, gentlest. And so when you get in that sort of mindset, and we're going to talk about this when we talk about mortification, sort of controlling our imagination a little bit, of going, yeah, I'm pretty sure that, you know, the worst thing that I could think would happen to me would be to be blind. I'm pretty sure God's going to take my eyes away from me, and therefore I'm scared of suffering. Right? Doesn't follow. But that's what we do. We take abstract, and then, whereas if we begin to look at things, where is God's will? Or when is God's will is even a better question. What is God's will for each one of you right here, right now? Right here, to be right here, right now, right? You know what I mean? Like, so in other words, you take it at the present moment, okay? That's, again, going back to God's providence, right? From all eternity, He planned for you all to be here, okay? And so what is His will for you? To be here, right here, right now, right? And again, not assuming that you didn't, you know, we won't get into the permissive will, like, you know, you really should have stayed home and studied, and that was really part of what His plan was, but He permitted you to be here, at worst case scenario, right? So God's will comes to us moment by moment, okay? And so we have nothing to fear, we just suffer whatever the moment has to offer us, all right? Just think about that for a second, okay? And that is a huge way, or a very different way to look at. Now, there's no fear of suffering. It's just that every moment is either yes God or no God. Okay? It's either yes. Remember earlier when I said, I think it was 2 weeks ago we were talking about, or 3 weeks ago, we were talking about always choosing the thing with more of the cross in it. You guys remember when I said that? That's what I meant by it, right? So at every moment, we can choose to be with Christ or not, to suffer with Christ or not. Right? And it's not in a sadistic way. God doesn't get pleasure from our suffering, but it changes us. Okay? And so when when our mind slides to, when I say things like, hey, who wants their purgatory now? That's because if you didn't raise your hand or you kind of waffled, it's because you didn't think about, oh, wait, like, I was thinking of fear in the abstract, okay? But it only comes at you in particular, right? So past, present, past and future are done, right? The past is done, future we have no idea. All right, and that, to me, is a huge stumbling block in our spiritual lives. All right, so let's talk a little bit about mortification then. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so just a little bit on suffering. Again, how to, not the intellectual problem of suffering, but.
That's not Saint Philomena.
Huh? That's
not Saint Philomena.
No, she was a nun who was named after her. Yeah, Saint Philomena, I think, was like 3rd century. Yeah, so it's a big difference. All right, so let's move towards mortification, okay? All right, so mortification, I won't tell you what mortification is. Let's first talk about what are the causes. I already said this earlier. We'll see if anyone's listening. What are the two causes of yielding to temptation?
Desiring the pleasure and then weakness of flesh.
Fear of pain and, yeah, well, the desire for the pleasure is the weakness of the flesh and then a fear of pain, right? So fear of suffering and a desire for pleasure. Okay, the two things that always cause us to sin. Can you think of a single sin in your own life? I can't. That wasn't ultimately driven by that. Or I haven't thought, I like the way that will turn out for me better than this. Or I'm scared of that, so I'll choose this. All right, so if that's true, then let's talk about what mortification is. The practice of Christian asceticism in order to overcome sin and master one's sinful tendencies. And through penance and austerity, you'll see penance and mortification are essentially the same thing. The difference is that penance has to do with past sins, whereas mortification has to do with present temptation, present and future temptations. So it's sort of like prepentance. Okay. So, and master one's sinful tendencies, and through penance and austerity, to strengthen the will and the practice of virtue and grow in the likeness of Christ. All right, so how do we do this? If I have tendencies, it's not even goes that specific. If it is pleasure and fear that drive everything that I do, when I choose against God, how do I stop that?
Do stuff you're afraid of, and don't do stuff you take pleasure in.
Well, that's a little extreme though, right? Like, see, this is, I mean, you're right, sort of.
I feel like you're obviously not going to do every single thing you're afraid of and do every single thing, not do everything you take pleasure in, but like picking things that you do find pleasure in and not doing those, and picking things you do fear and doing them, I feel like that's not overstepping yourself.
Yeah, so why is that effective though? I'm not saying you're wrong. I mean, now that you sort of qualified it, I agree with you, but why is that effective? Yes. So then I said, say it more confidently. That was, you're dead on. Make sure they get it on the recording. Because we're rejecting our own will. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to embarrass you. We don't know who that was. She just walked in. She's gone now. No, it is a matter of thy will be done, right? And so what do we do? Well, in certain places, we mortify our will, right? We say, I would really like this whole this whole plate of food. That would bring me great pleasure, but I'm going to leave a little bit on the plate. I would really like to sleep 10 more minutes and hit the snooze button, but that's just driven by comfort. I'm going to get up now. Okay? I mean, these are practical things, right? Because what happens? Well, we gain mastery. Remember, we talked about the psychology, how we gain mastery over ourselves, right? It's just very simple things where we say no to something that is perfectly good, or we leave a little bit of pleasure on the table, right? Or we step out of our comfort zone a little bit, okay? I really don't like talking to that person. I'm going to send them an email. No, I'm going to call them up. Right? So all these, I mean, these are all little things, okay? And so there's a negative aspect to it, right, where we renounce something, but it's ultimately a positive thing. Yes?
So forever ago, we were talking about temperaments, and you said colleagues like mortification. Does that somehow mean it's less effective?
Yes. As a colleague, yes, because we choose, and we'll talk about a way to do that. Because I get pride in how well I can mortify. but there's a way around it. We'll talk about it in a second. All right. But so mortification then is not so much about just giving something up. Okay, it's so that we get mastery of ourselves, so that we are ready to do the will of God, okay? Or grow in the likeness of Christ. So there's a tendency, right, especially as a guy, like guys like battles to fight, that you think, oh, I'm going to be really austere, and this is going to be great, right? That's missing what you're trying to do, especially a choleric will say that, like, oh, this is awesome. But you got to remember what the point, right? Those are, like, this is a means to that end. Right? And so I have to mortify my mortification, if that makes sense, as a choleric, as someone who's prone to pride.
Just do whatever you want?
No. Well, sometimes I have to force myself to, like, for example, being very driven, sometimes I have to force myself not to do something. And that ends up really being hard for me to do, even though it seems like I should do it, right? Like, I have plenty of examples here, so we'll talk about it. Hold on. So what I did for the next, like, three or four slides is there's a document, and I'll make sure that it gets on the website. Sorry, I try to squeeze as many of these on these slides as I can so that we can talk about them. That is what's called a mortification plan. It was written in the 20th century by a Cardinal Mercier. And he basically went through all the sort of spiritual writers, and he came up with all these ways in which you can mortify yourself. And you'll see a lot of these are just very simple. So he says, regulate your sleep, avoiding this, all faintheartedness, some of this is a little bit older, all softness, especially in the morning. Set an hour if you can for going to bed and getting up, and keep strictly to it. Right. Extremely hard for you guys, I know. Just, you know what? I need to not binge watch that next episode. I'm going to turn it off. Again, what happens? Well, I get a little more self-mastery, right? If I'm able to say no to a good thing, I'm much quicker to say no to a bad thing. All right? And that part of it is really important for us to understand. That's the purpose of Lent and penance and Lent and mortification, is saying no to certain good things so that it makes it much easier for us to say no to bad things. And then as we sort of grow, then we can even say no to good things, because they don't help us get closer to God, right? So that's the goal. We sort of move from, and we're going to move in that direction we talked about at the beginning, right? So we start out where we love God. That's a great thing, but we still love ourselves more than we love God. Right? And each time we do this, it sort of now gets, the playing field gets a little bit even, more even, and then we want to get to the point where we go, oh yeah, watching this isn't for the glory of God, doesn't help me get closer to Him, I'm not going to watch it. And again, there's all kinds of reasons why, you know, even having leisure is a good thing, and it does help you get closer to God. So it's not like you're joyless. In fact, you actually can appreciate things much better because you can see them through God's eyes, you can see things as truly good as they truly are. All right, so the first one it says, regulate sleep. Mortify your mood. All right, so often we just sort of allow our moods to dominate what we do, okay? and I definitely mean we, like I am in that group. I have a bad day, I think I want to go home and just be, just kind of, right? But then if I'm cheerful, even though I don't feel like it, suddenly I've mastered my mood, okay? And then I eventually get the virtue, okay? Guard against making the slightest illness a reason for dispensation or exemption from your daily schedule or for special treatment. That one sort of is obvious. Close your eyes always and above all to every dangerous sight, and even, have the courage to do it, to every frivolous and useless sight. This is what I was talking about this sort of frivolity. See without looking. Do not gaze at anybody to judge of their beauty or ugliness. Like, how hard is that, right? I believe that without comment. Go ahead.
Go back to mood for a second.
Yeah.
Is that to say that you should be cheerful 100% of the time?
No, if you go to a funeral and you're cheerful, there's like something wrong with you, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But like,
so mood is just, is more of how do you, like, how you feel. You know, you just wake up on the wrong side of the bed. So it doesn't mean, you just do something to be counter to it, right? You could also be, like, overly exuberant and really annoying, and then you need to temper it. Your mood may, so in other words, you want to be, you don't want your mood to drive the situation. Rather than, you know, you want the situation, like, you want how you should be to drive your mood. So it's gaining back control of your emotions and your passions. Does that make sense?
So let's say I'm in a group situation or whatever, but I'm, like, kind of getting introspective and, like, kind of, like, zoning out and just thinking about something. Like, is it bad then to do that? So I should, like, force myself to...
No, that's not a mood, right? So a mood, I think, would be more of no rational explanation for really how you feel.
Okay.
Like... You just kind of, you know, just feel like being pissy, like giving people a hard time. You just feel like being argumentative, or, you know, somebody's having, you're having a conversation with someone and they're kind of a contrarian, and you're like, they're really annoying me. I'm going to just, that's the idea. Yes.
I mean, I also think it was like sometimes like you have taken a decision considering like all the good things, and you know you have to do it for the next 7 days. Sometimes I might feel very happy doing it. Sometimes I might not feel as motivated to do it. But still, if you have already taken a decision, just keep doing it.
Yes. Yeah, and we'll talk more about that idea when we talk about the sermon. But this idea of if you've made a decision, you don't let your mood take that decision away. Before I go to the next one, let's talk a little bit just very quickly about just virtue in general. And we're going to talk about this in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So everyone sort of knows what a virtue is, right? It's a firm and habitual disposition to do some good, right? So let's just say, let's just take the virtue of service, right? When somebody, so let's say your roommate is sick, okay? And they come to you at 10 o'clock and they're like, hey, I really need you to go to Walmart and get me some cold medicine, okay? And you kind of look at him and you're like, you're really that sick? Let's go get your own cold medicine, right? Or you might go, yeah, okay, that's fine. Okay. And you're going to go grudgingly, and you don't really feel like going. But then you end up going, okay? So you've done an act of service, okay? Done an act of charity. Then the next, they get your other roommate sick, and the next night they come to you and like, hey, you go to Walmart and get me some cold medicine. You're like, dude, why did they drink the whole bottle of cough medicine? But you're like, okay. Like, so you get a little bit more, you're like, yeah, I'll do that. All right. And you're still kind of grudgingly going the whole time. You're like, seriously, like, I'm about to stay up late again. Then the third night happens again, right? And suddenly you go, and now you're kind of like, a little pleasure in this. Okay. I don't mind this so much. And then do another act of charity, a little bit more. You're like, huh, you know, there's a little bit of sweetness to this. Still hard, still annoying, but there's now a sweetness to it, okay? That's what a virtue is. That's joy, okay? That sweetness of doing something, that's what joy is, okay? And that's why how you can have joy in suffering, where you can go, oh, okay, even though I'm suffering, I know there's good to this, and I'm okay with that, okay? There's a little bit of sweetness to it, right? So... just like a tree, right? When a tree produces fruit, it means that the tree is mature, right? It has a little bit of sweetness to it. So that's the goal, okay? So that when these hard things happen, remember I said at the beginning, God gave us pleasure, not just physical bodily pleasure, but pleasure in order to spur us on. But when you have a virtue, there's pleasure attached to that thing, okay? And there can be pleasure attached to mortification, right? This is why people have joy when they're suffering, even though it's hard and arduous. There's still a certain amount of peace that comes with it, a certain amount of joy. Like that's the idea, okay? We'll talk more about this when we talk about virtues. But that's what we're shooting for here, okay? That's our goal, is to become the kind of person, not who can get up when the alarm goes off the first time, but the person who always responds promptly to whatever's needed at the time, all right? And we can't get from A to B without passing through C, okay? right, look. So, do you guys see what A and B and C are?
Is Eva passing through
D? Yeah, I kind of did say that wrong. I know what your face now is for. Sure, you can't get from A to C without passing through B. Right, thank you.
Makes so much more sense.
Yeah. yes?
So I have to leave, but could you definitely talk about the color thing and all this and later?
Yeah, I will. All right. So bear with everything which naturally grieves the flesh, especially the cold, the winter, the heat of summer, a hard bed, and every inconvenience of that kind. St. Francis de Sales says, I am never better than when I am not well. That one I know. Okay, no, got cut off. I like the catechism one. He says, I am never better than when I am not well. So a little bit of discomfort is good for us. Okay, for many, many reasons. All right. A shower that's a little bit cold is good for us. Right? I keep telling myself that. All right, so that is sort of just some examples of bodily mortifications, right? Nothing all that profound, right? We take our situation and we look at ways we can leave a little bit of pleasure on the table. All right? And just to be clear, you don't mortify something that's bad. All right? I think you guys sort of know that, right? Like you don't go, oh, I'm going to, you know, stop, you know, punching my friend in the face every 5 minutes. That's probably a good idea to stop, but that's not mortification. All right. So we've talked a lot about this already, and this is where I want us to sort of spend a little bit of time mortifying our imagination and our memory. Okay. And here's some examples, and then we'll talk about why these are so important. So mortify your imagination when it beguiles you with the lure of a brilliant position, when it saddens you with the prospect of a dreary future, when it irritates you with a memory of a word or a deed which offended you, if you feel within you the need to daydream, mortify it without mercy. All right. Why is that a good practice?
I think you are giving too much importance to yourself.
That's part of it.
When you daydream, it's not real.
Where did I say God's will was?
Now.
Here and now, right? So if I'm sitting there, I'm daydreaming about what could happen. What good is that, right? How is that helping me? Okay. We all do this, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of our reality of, but it goes the other way too. Like something that was really unpleasant, somebody who crossed you, don't keep dwelling on it. All right? And it starts with, again, this is not easy to do, but it starts with the simple thing of when you catch yourself daydreaming, stop. Okay? And then you'll find that you actually have the control that when you're dwelling on past hurts or something, that you can actually stop, okay? Because you don't get in that rat race going on in your head. This also has to do with what I said about fear of the abstract, because we always tend to go to the worst possible scenarios or the best possible cases, right? And whereas that's not usually how things happen. Okay. So daydreaming helps us, stopping daydreaming. The other thing too, just to be clear, it's very difficult. This is even just a semantic thing to say. I'm not going to think about X, right? Because what was the very beginning of what we talked about? When we talked about psychology. When you say something, what comes into your mind?
That thing,
right? It comes into your imagination. So you have to replace it. Okay, you have to replace it with good things. Right? This is why St. Paul says, whatever is good, whatever is holy, dwell on those things. Okay, so we have to have something to replace it with. You can't just go, I'm going to stop thinking about him doing that to me. And then immediately, oh, what? Thinking about it again. Man, I'm terrible. Oh, I'm doing it again. So you have to put something in there in its place, okay? And then, and then once you begin to do this, again, a very simple thing. Okay, I'm not going to daydream any longer. Yet, we get out of the past and the future. But we also, when we go to pray, now our imagination is under control. And it's not running all over the place. All right? Mortify the natural organ of your mind, which is to say the tongue. Okay? What do they mean by this? Watch what you say. Right? Like, avoid extreme language. And I don't mean, like, saying things meanly, but just avoid saying, like, always. And if something doesn't need to be said, don't say it. Because eventually, if you don't say it, you stop thinking it. Okay? So you kind of feed it when you say it, because now it's out there. And you might have to explain it, you may have to... so just only say what needs to be said. And then guard what the eyes look upon so as to protect your imagination and memory. That is what we've talked about, I think, numerous times about limiting what we watch on TV, what we look at, especially guys, right? Because we're very visual. And things that, you know, I saw as a kid, I can still see to this day. Okay, so...
Rob, could you elaborate more on...
Yeah, so so there's a modesty in the way we speak about things, and what tends to happen when we say, when we're like, I'm never doing that again, right? Or I'm never talking to that person again. Let's use that one, right? We don't mean it that way. We mean it more in the sense of, oh, I'm upset at that person, right? And what that does is when we use extreme language like that, we harden ourselves. And so just use modesty in your speech. Plus, to be honest with you, it's really annoying talking to people like that. Like,
yeah.
You know, people who tend to be, you know, always in the extremes. Like, everything is the worst. I used to have a friend that he's like, we'd just be sitting around and he goes, okay, top 10 Tom Cruise movies. Like, he'd always want to rank things and then he'd argue with you about 2 and 1. And like, everything had to be like best ever, worst ever. I used to call him the superlatator.
Yeah.
It was like everything was like a superlative. So that's what I'm talking about. Do that. And after a while, you know what? He did get to be a little annoying. You know, it was fun to talk about the top 10 first basemen, you know, in the American League. with the first name that began with B. but after a while, it's just, you know, it was like, okay, so yes. So even my kids started calling him the superlative. Yes.
Those were from a book, right? Could you upload it?
Yes, I will put it, I will make sure it gets on there. Okay. It's just it's like a 9-page document. I'll make sure it gets on there.
I'm sure every line is hard to do.
Yeah. And what I would do with that, I mean, practically speaking, would be pick one or two of them, right? And especially when we talk next week about the 7 deadly sins and your predominant fault, pick one that attacks that. All right. Don't try to do like 20 of them because you'll forget and you won't be very successful at it. Trust me. All right. So mortifying the intellect. This is a bigger one than you think. And this is definitely sort of geared towards students, as St. Thomas has advice to students. It says, do not be content to take in superficially what you read and hear, but endeavor to go into it deeply and to fathom the whole sense of it. Never remain in doubt about what you could know with certainty. Work with a holy eagerness to enrich your mind, arraign and classify in your memory all the knowledge you are able to acquire. On the other hand, do not seek to penetrate mysteries which are beyond your intelligence. All right, well, so what does he mean by this? All right, so the first thing he's saying is, if you're going to try to understand something, then don't try to read 10,000 miles a minute. Actually sit and try to understand it. Okay. So as a student, what is God's will for you? To be a student, right? You're now. So when you plumb the depths of whatever you're studying, it doesn't have to be theology, and you come to really understand who are you glorifying as an act of obedience? Yeah. Right? And so when you put, you know, this is your station in life, this is what God's called you to do. So when you put the effort into understanding something, that is a good thing. Okay? And you should do that. And he says, never remain in doubt about what you can know with certainty. So if you can figure something out, then you should spend the time to figure it out. Right? And again, there's a little bit of prudence there as to, you know, what, you know, why do I really need to know this? All those things. But the point is that if you're going to spend the time doing it, do it well. Because it's what God wants for you right now. Yes, Ryan.
Something you said in here kind of like made me think about something you mentioned earlier, and I had a question about it. But
okay.
You can answer it after if you want.
No, go ahead.
So say someone has like chosen to live their life in a particularly simple way with the understanding that God allows evil or permits it, and that wherever we are in our stage of life is because God has allowed it or willed it. Couldn't they just make the argument that, oh, I've chosen this sin, therefore God has allowed it?
They could make that argument, but it wouldn't be very good. No, all of this, assuming everything we're saying, is that we're actually striving to do God's will. Right? So they're not striving to do God's will. Right, so that's the, you know, you want to do what God wants you to do. Well, God doesn't want you to sin. So God can bring about, the other part of it, God can bring about good from evil, but we can't. Right, that's a sort of an understanding of just his total goodness that he can do that. So, in fact, that's what part of, like, the temptation is, that one of the temptations Satan throws at Christ in today's gospel, right? He's like, just throw yourself off. He's like, no, you don't tempt God. That's what that person is doing. They're tempting God. Okay. Does that make sense? All right. Never remain in doubt about what you can know with certainty. Work with a holy eagerness to enrich your mind. Arrange and classify in your memory all the knowledge you are able to acquire. By the way, just because this sort of fits here, what St. Thomas is saying is don't compartmentalize your life. I think, hey, this is religious, Ryan. This is work, Ryan. So, you know, I'm just going to focus on this stuff for work that really doesn't have anything to do with my sanctification. It's just something I have to tolerate until I can get over here and go pray, right? They all fit together, all right? And so resist the temptation to compartmentalize and think, oh, well, this just belongs over here. And he's saying if it's a good thing, then you should work to understand it, because God is found in that too. On the other hand, do not seek to penetrate mysteries which are beyond your intelligence. I think this is one I probably don't listen to enough. But the idea is that if something is beyond you, leave it. Like, focus on the things that you can focus on. Yes?
But how do we know the difference?
That's prudence, right? Knowing, sort of the practical wisdom of knowing, we don't always know, right? But if I sat here and I tried to pick up some kind of advanced physics book, and I'm like, I'm gonna really understand this. That's way beyond me at this point. So I would know that. But are there some cases where there might be a little overlap? Sure.
No, I'm thinking like, thinking about the Trinity. Right? We know that we can't really understand it. But we'll have analogies or something that help us understand it, but where do we stop?
I would stop where devotion stops. So where you stop going, you know, God is amazing, or like when you start really getting to the point where you have hit a roadblock where now it's just become an intellectual problem, that's where you stop. Does that make sense?
Yeah. in the first part of the writing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Trinity is a bad example because it's, no offense, it's a bad example because it's a mystery, right? So you can't fully grasp it. If you take something that's not a mystery of the faith, then you should keep plumbing the depths. But there's another part of this too that he doesn't talk about that's really important, and that's curiosity. All right, curiosity is not a good thing, despite what everyone says. All right, so everyone knows the difference between curiosity and studiousness. So studiousness is a virtue, curiosity is a vice. So curiosity is choosing to know something just for the pleasure of knowing. So it has no value to you perfectly. So think of the last time you were on Facebook while you were on there. Okay, that's curiosity. All right, just hey, I don't want to miss out, or hey, I wonder what they're doing. Hey, all those things. Okay, again, I'm not saying Facebook is a bad thing, but I'm saying it is really driven by curiosity. Okay, the vice of curiosity. So there's just a certain pleasure in knowing something, just for the sake, because we're meant to know, right? But if it's not profitable to us, then we don't need to know, all right? And it actually ends up, I mean, besides being like a huge time waster, it actually ends up harming us spiritually too. Because then when the time comes to actually buckle down and actually learn something or know about something we have to know, we keep thinking about, I'm just going to check Facebook for a second. Right? And I think we've all had that experience, right? That's when we know, okay, that I need to conquer the vice of curiosity. Okay, because that's what's driving me to, while I'm supposed to be doing this, which knowledge that I can profit from, now I'm turning to this, which is just knowledge because I like to hear about it. Okay? And again, does it have its use? Yes. Right? But it's very easy to make, you know, to abuse it. So that's the other part of it, is to really spend time you know, learning to know things that actually help us. Okay. All right. So mortifying the will. Above all, mortify your will. That is the decisive point. Bend it constantly to know, to what you know is God's good pleasure and the rule of providence, without taking any account either of your likes or dislikes. Be submissive even to your inferiors in matters which do not concern the glory of God and the duties of your position. So if you read St. Faustina's diary, she has two pages in the middle of her diary with big X's in them. And she says, that was my will. I'll never do it again. So she would choose in things that, again, but not things that are sinful, not, but she would mortify her will so completely that she would never choose what she wanted, solely because she wanted it. Okay. Why did she do that? Not because she wanted to punish herself, because she wanted to do God's will. Okay. All right, so this is the one of the secrets of the choleric. Are there any other cholerics in here? Okay. So this is a hard one for us. And one that is on my mortification list of I try to defer to everyone else on things that don't matter, okay? And so this habit of just letting other people have their way. Even when it, you know, I can think of a better way to do it, even when I, you know, could do it much faster, all those things, okay? And you know, when you get married, this is actually a good skill to actually learn how to do. Mm-hmm. So you just defer your will, okay? Yes.
Does that mean the melancholic and phlegmatic should do the opposite?
Be more assertive?
Yeah. In trivial matters.
That's a good question. I would say no, probably not. Yeah, I think this is probably a good practice for everyone, but a choleric has a particular difficulty in doing this, especially this choleric. But I would say this is a good practice for everyone, not just a choleric. Yes, Ryan.
I think it was Augustine that said, love God and do your will. How do you distinguish?
Well, if you truly love God, you're always doing his will, right? Love God and do what you will. Mm-hmm. He meant it as in, once you truly love God, you will, because again, what's the point to do the will of God, right? And so this is the other part about the other part of being a choleric, is that's why a choleric will always, or we all should, choose the harder of two things. Because, one, because it has more of the cross in it, but two, because it has less of my will in it. Like, you put something before me, especially my personality, that's hard, and I'll do it, because there's a lot of glory in that. Put something in front of me that's really hard for me personally, and I'll choose the easier thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's like doing housework. Like, I don't know how to fix the lawnmower, but the laundry really needs to be folded. I'll do the laundry because that's easier. Whereas I should do that which is harder. Okay, but that's why we choose harder things, not because we're masochists. Because it helps sets us up. Now the fact that something is hard and God's asking me to do it is no longer an obstacle. I can do the harder. I can do the easy. Whatever.
Is it just like a well-informed conscious thing? Like, how is it Faustina that next up her diary?
Yeah, I mean, she knew, well, she was very close to God, but she knew that her will was a stumbling block to getting to God, no matter how close she was. So, yeah, I mean, again, you do have to have sort of a, anything questionable, you shouldn't go against your conscience. But, you know, just in general thing, like, even if you stay away from, like, sort of highly moral issues, even to practice this is really difficult. I know because I failed numerous times doing it. But it's a way to clear up, you know, sort of clear the path for God's will. All right, let's talk for the last 10 minutes or so about fasting. Okay. So part of Lent is to obviously is to fast. It's one of the spiritual practices of. And I actually think I want to start here instead of that. That's how I'm going to go back to it. So when the Pharisees came to Jesus, they asked him why the followers of John the Baptist and the Pharisees fast much, but his disciples didn't. And Jesus said, "Can a wedding guest mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. No one patches an old cloak with a piece of unshrunken cloth, for its fullness pulls away from the cloak and tears get worse. People do not put new wine into old wineskins." What is Jesus talking about? About not fasting, not fasting, then fasting. So what are we, how do we take, what do we take away from this?
There's a time to fast, a time not to fast.
Okay. So there's a time to fast, time not to fast. What about the fact that he says that his disciples will fast? So that would mean that we all should be fast. If we're Christ's disciples, we all should be fasting, right? But he also says, this is really popular sort of in the New Age movement, there's a very Christian way of fasting, then, right? This is what he means about no one fasts while the bridegroom is with them, only when he leaves. So the Jewish people would fast as a sign of penance, but also as a sign of expectation. Okay, they would let something that was necessary for the life go because they were waiting for the Messiah. This person that was really necessary. And so they had two reasons to fast. That's the old wineskins, okay? And Jesus says, well, there's the new wineskins. What are the new wineskins? Well, what did Jesus do in today's gospel? Fasted, right? So, based on what I said last week about Jesus and his life, what does that mean for us? If Jesus did it, what does it mean?
We should do it
as an example, but there was a second part of that. Remember, we talked a long time, made sure you guys really understood that when Jesus did something, he attached graces to that thing for us to have, right? So the Christian way of fasting, now fasting becomes a source not just of penance, but of sanctification. Okay, so when we fast, who are we fasting with? Jesus in the desert, right? Okay. Do we have to fast for 40 days, no food and water? No. Right? Do we have to fast for a day? Probably. What if we can't fast for a day? Is that okay? Does this have to be a legalistic thing or not? Okay. So, all right, so we get the point of, so why is fasting so powerful? And we'll talk about how to actually fast in a minute. What? So Jesus has attached graces to it. But why fasting? What's the logic of fasting?
By giving something up, you're creating room for something else to come.
Yeah, so you're taking something, back to what we said, right? Taking something that's necessary and then going for the one thing that's necessary, right? Mm-hmm. Substituting it. So, yes. But what was the first sin? What did they do? They ate, right? They ate something. Okay? So by not eating, you're sort of talking about the time of redemption, right? Like, okay, the time of original sin ruling the world is over. And so now we can abstain, right? So think of what our first parents did, right? They ate something. Does anyone know why meat? Why, like, when we, one of the things we fast from is meat?
Because it was, like, a much bigger part of the diet back when that first started?
Probably not, actually.
Because it tastes good.
The meat does taste good, yes.
It's because meat is more of a luxury, right?
It can be sort of a luxury, but... So today's first reading was about, you guys remember, it was about Noah. And then their very next line that they didn't put in was God saying that Noah could eat the meat of the flesh of the animals. Okay. So it was a concession that God made because of original sin. And so when we abstain from meat on Fridays, for example, we're saying, okay, the time of redemption is at hand. God is beginning to fix. You know, all creation is groaning, waiting for the redemption of the body. Well, this is a sign that it's started and it's going. Okay, so that's why we fast from meat. But there's other reasons why we fast. So St. Thomas says that fasting is part of the natural law, meaning everyone should do it, regardless of whether the church says you should do it. And he says the first reason is that it helps with chastity. He calls it the guardian of chastity. And again, if you can control something so sort of primal and needed as eating, you can control sort of other primal drives. Okay, so it's called the guardian of chastity for a reason. In fact, even says lust is cooled by abstinence from eating drink. So people who are really hungry tend not to be inflicted with lust. The second is so that in order that the mind may arise more freely to the contemplation of heavenly things. So this is one that. That everyone who fasts experiences. Okay, there's a clarity in your thinking, again, not after 40 days and 40 nights, that's just, you know, it's hard to describe, but there's a clarity in thinking that other times you don't have. I don't know why that is, per se, but people describe, I'm able to pray better, I'm able to think better, I'm able to focus better. Again, not making themselves starving so that they're focused on their stomach, but just that little bit of discomfort of being hungry, for whatever reason, clears our mind. And then the last is the obvious thing, that it's a form of penance. All right, so how do we do it? So the first is a total fast of food, from food and water, like our Lord in the desert and linked to the Eucharistic fast. So this is not just like 40 days, 40 nights. So some people, when they fast, will fast, will have nothing, put nothing in their mouth. No bread, no water. Then what the church prescribes is to have one small meal with two additional meals that add up to the size of the other meal. So on days you fast, you would eat a sort of a regular size meal, and then the other two meals would add up to the size of the other one. So there's a genius in the second one. It seems like, okay, well, I'm a lightweight if I have to do the second one, right? Well, first of all, don't do that, right? Because it's not, again, it's not taking on the greatest sacrifices, right? It's the spirit in which you take the sacrifice in. But again, for someone who struggles with pride, it's much better to mortify your mortifications. That's what I meant, okay? So you know, I told you guys earlier, I think John Claw's not here, so I can feel comfortable saying this, that I really, like, canon law, I have no interest in it at all. But the one place I do have it is on fasting. Because I know my tendencies, like, if you tell me I have to fast, that's fine. Tell me, you know, I'll do it. You know, I won't drink water from midnight to 11:59. I won't touch a drop of water. I won't, even when I go in the shower, I'll take my mouth shut. All these really, because I can do that, okay? What I do is go into canon law and go, okay, that's me. That's not a sacrifice. That's, you know, me seeing how much I can do this. So I go into canon law and go, okay, what's the letter of the law here? I'm going to follow that very specifically. So now it becomes an act of obedience, an act of humility. Okay, they say I have to do one small meal, two small meals, add up, that's what I'm going to do. Or else fasting then becomes just a source of pride. So in that regard, if you have that tendency in anything, right, when you start thinking, well, I'm so much better fasting than you know, Ryan is or whatever. When that mindset goes in there, you go, okay, I need to back off a little bit, right? And same thing with, like, certain things, again, just knowing my tendency, right? Like if someone offers me a kneeler, for example, I will take the kneeler because I really want to kneel on the floor, okay? And it's hard. I have to mortify my pride to go, oh, no, you know, I'll just be like everybody else and go on the kneel or things like that, okay? So this, again, is sort of a preview of what we're going to talk about next week, but to know your tendencies, right? And then, you know, the story in the gospel of the Pharisee who goes, I'm glad I'm not like that guy in the back. Right, that's pride can do that to us. That's like all of us in some ways, and so even, you know, these can even be traps for us if we're not careful. All right, so there's the, if you want to read them, there are the canons on fasting, and that I will say the last part I have is just a quote from Benedict the 14th from the 16th century. Says the observance of the Lenten fast is the very badge of the Christian warfare. By it we prove ourselves not to be enemies of the cross of Christ. By it we avert the scourges of divine justice. By it we gain strength against the princes of darkness, for it shields us with heavenly help. Should mankind grow remiss in their observance of Lent, it would be a detriment to God's glory, a disgrace to Catholic religion, and a danger to Christian souls. Neither can it be doubted that such negligence would become the source of misery to the world, a public calamity, and a private woe. Like, that sounds really dramatic, but, you know, that, I think he's, well, he's a pope and I'm not, so, I think he's dead on that it, you know, that much of the graces we have throughout the year are won for us during Lent. Like, and so we should really take Lent seriously and take it as a time to really, really gain as many graces as we can. All right, questions? So one of the questions, when I usually talk about this, is what about, like, okay, do I have to fast from food? And the answer is yes.
Well, for that specifically. Yes. But I mean, like, during all of
that. No, I mean, again, well, everything we talked about wasn't fasting from food, right? But when we specifically talk about fasting, and fasting belongs in its own sort of category, you should fast from food. So don't, like, get in the habit of going on fasting from Netflix. That's a sacrifice, and that's a penance or mortification or whatever, but it's not the same thing as fasting. And if you're not, again, this is not about, you know, manning up and trying to do everything you can. If you can only fast until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that's fine. It's the spirit in which it's done, and if you're giving effort to get there, then do it. And don't not do it for that reason. But by the same token, sometimes if we set it too high and we fail, we stop. I've done that numerous times where I'm like, and really, I was fasting today and I really ate too much at dinner. Forget it. I'll just have this piece of cake too. I hope it's a natural tendency for us to do that and think, oh, I failed, or just get back on the horse and start again. It's not about somehow, like, making your diet for Lent holy or something. I would need to lose 10 pounds anyway, so I think I'll just fast. All right, so questions. So next week we will talk about 7 deadly sins, and then by the end we'll talk about how to sort of come up with your predominant fault, so you can start looking at attacking that thing head on. And then the next will be spiritual warfare. So you see, we sort of did the two of our enemies, right? The flesh and the devil. I'll leave the world to you guys. So once we get through that, then we'll talk about what God arms us with. All right. All right, who wants to pray?